the race, you're running it, and your immediate thought is, I'm already maxed out. She's going faster than me. I can't keep up. Let her go. Instantly, you think about your immediate thoughts. Is it really true that you're maxed out and can't run even 2 seconds a mile faster? What about those times in workouts when you've pushed hard at the end and, instead of spontaneously combusting, ran faster? Why not try that now? Why not get in her slipstream and see how long you can stay with her? Won't you be happier for at least trying? Wouldn't you rather finish a few seconds faster? In that fraction of a second, you decide your first thoughts weren't legitimate. You go with the other runner. Your agony level doesn't increase unbearably. You finish right behind her and wind up with your best 5K time of the year. Without knowing it, you've just applied cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, a common technique that mental health therapists help people with depression or anxiety use to manage their internal dialogue and resulting actions. When running, especially when pushing ourselves, almost all of us have negative thoughts that run counter to our goals. But over time, we learn that simply having the thoughts doesn't mean we need to grant them legitimacy. We acknowledge them, examine them, and consider the consequences of following them. Usually we set them aside and get back to the task at hand, because we know we'll be happier with ourselves later for seeing things through. So, if, as runners with depression or anxiety, we wind up seeing a therapist who recommends CBT, we're already a few steps ahead. And we have another advantage. The CBT we instinctively practice as runners might also lead to greater pain tolerance and build a resilience that we can draw on in difficult non-running situations. What is cognitive behavioral therapy? CBT was created in the 1960s and formalized in the 1970s. It bridges traditional psychotherapy, focused on the feelings a person has, and behavioral therapy, focused on a person's actions. The bridge is CBT's emphasis on how thoughts, for example, the cognitive part of CBT, lead to feelings, which lead to behaviors. In the earlier racing example, the initial thought, I'm already maxed out, I can't keep up with the runner who just passed me, might lead to feeling defeated, which might lead to not trying to match the other runner's pace. The second round of thoughts, such as, just try tucking in and see how long you can get pulled along, might lead to feeling capable and newly inspired, which might lead to syncing your stride with the other runners and being able to increase your pace. The goal of CBT is to produce behaviors that reduce rather than add to your problems and thereby improve your feelings. One of its key insights is that self-defeating behaviors often stem from negative thoughts that seem to arrive automatically in the mind. For example, during a tough afternoon at work, someone with a drinking problem might immediately think, "I deserve a bottle of wine after this miserable day." CBT can help such a person recognize what's behind the thought. For example, an unreasonable workload, a bad boss, and challenge both its validity and the proposed way to address it. CBT would help the person with the drinking problem see that even if it's true that their workload and boss are to blame, getting drunk will not solve those problems, but will create others. The better choice in this situation, not drinking, will lead to feeling better about themselves. It might also lead to substitute behaviors, such as meditating or calling a friend, that will produce positive feelings, such as calmness and being connected. In its situational use, CBT is focused on short-term outcomes. Therapists help clients recognize the automatic thought patterns that lead to undesirable feelings and subsequent behaviors. I can't go to work today because something disastrous is going to happen. It doesn't matter what I do, so why bother getting out of bed? And so on. Therapists then help clients devise and practice alternative strategies that, by leading to better actions, result in feeling better. At the same time, CBT is a long-term technique in that once you learn how to use it, it's available in any challenging setting for the rest of your life. Its viability outside a therapist's office makes CBT one of the most effective tools for improving symptoms in people with depression and anxiety. Some studies have found CBT to be as effective as antidepressants in treating mild to moderate depression. Research has also found that people using CBT instead of antidepressants have a much lower incidence of experiencing a new depressive episode. Of course, a variable with CBT is the quality of therapy you receive. An excellent practitioner might better teach you to successfully practice CBT, whereas presumably a given antidepressant should affect you similarly, regardless of what pharmacy you frequent. Frank Brooks, PhD, is a professor of social work and strong advocate of CBT. He thinks that the specific change in thinking that occurs in CBT might have lasting effects on the brain. Let's take obsessive-compulsive disorder, he says. Sometimes medication is a successful treatment. What's happening there is probably an increase in neurotransmitters to that part of the brain that has control over OCD. But people have overcome its worst symptoms through CBT or other interventions that have nothing to do with neurotransmitters. So how does that happen? Do CBT and other cognitive interventions reshape the brain too? There's starting to be evidence that's true. For example, one review of research looked at whether the brains of people with anxiety changed after they began using CBT, as determined by neuroimaging. It did indeed find structural changes in the brain, specifically that CBT modified the neural circuits involved in the regulation of negative emotions and fear extinction. These profound changes can happen relatively quickly. A Swedish study found that the part of the brain known as the amygdala shrank in people with social anxiety disorder after just 9 weeks of internet-based CBT. Activity in the amygdala decreased along with its size. In this case, brain shrinkage is good because the amygdala is key to how we respond to and remember emotions, especially fear. These changes coincided with the people reporting significant improvement in their symptoms of social anxiety. CBT and the structural changes it appears to produce are perhaps even more effective when combined with the brain changes brought about by exercise, such as increased circulation of neurotransmitters. That 1+1=3 effect makes pairing CBT with exercise a go-to treatment for people with depression and anxiety. What's perhaps not as well appreciated is how being a runner primes us for success in using CBT. The runner's advantage with CBT. I met Brooks as one of his clients. In one of our first sessions, as he started describing CBT, my thoughts drifted toward running. What Brooks was recommending as a cornerstone treatment for my depression and related issues was instantly familiar. It was the same cognitive process I'd used the previous 3 decades to counter such thoughts as, I can't hold this pace to the finish. That 5th repeat was much harder than it should have been. I can't do 3 more. Or, another hour of running? That doesn't seem possible. When, years later, I told Brooks that I was able to meet our therapy goals because I told myself I already knew from running how to practice CBT, he said, I think that's brilliant. He is, as you would hope, a very supportive person. What CBT teaches people to do is challenge automatic thoughts, Brooks says. When you're running, you might have the thought, I can't keep this up. You very quickly go through the evidence whether that's true. Yes, you probably have some physical evidence that you're in pain, but then you also counter that thought. Even though I feel this way, last time I did too, and I got through it. So even though I feel this way, I can continue on. As Brooks notes, the type of thinking we often use running is more sophisticated than repeating hackneyed mantras such as, Pain is temporary, pride forever. Or, the difference between champ and chump is you. It's a process of acknowledging unhelpful thoughts and then coming up with reasons that those thoughts aren't legitimate. Brooks agrees that runners using CBT to address mental health issues could be at an advantage. What people learn through CBT is that they can effectively challenge automatic negative thoughts. Most people don't know that when they start CBT. They think that thoughts are reality, that these thoughts are who and what we are, and that we don't really have any control over them. For people with high anxiety and deep depression, those thought patterns are really ironclad. This is who I am, and I can't change anything about it. With your running, you already knew that's not the case. You already knew how to challenge those negative thoughts. One of my running partners, Kristen Berry, says that CBT regularly practiced in running carries over into managing her depression. Running has helped me to acknowledge a negative thought and then reframe it. The two-time Olympic marathon trials qualifier says, when I was running well and I would have self-doubt, I would acknowledge the thought and then quickly counter it with something pre-planned of why I was ready to do X. When dealing with automatic thoughts that can prompt or worsen her depression, Berry says, it's really just a different application of the same kind of thing. Another of my running partners, Heather Johnson, specifically uses running to practice CBT, which helps her manage anxiety. Training and incorporating tempos, intervals, and other hard efforts are great ways to combat negative self-talk and accept and push through discomfort, she says. Indeed, our regular use of CBT while running may create a positive feedback loop of ever greater ability to handle difficult situations. Runners really are tougher. Research backs what we'd like to believe about ourselves. Runners and other endurance athletes are tougher than sedentary people. Studies have found that we're better at holding up to and managing pain. Experts believe these attributes are more the result of our training and racing than inherent traits. First, some terminology. Research on pain distinguishes between pain threshold and pain tolerance. Pain threshold is when you first describe a situation as painful. Pain tolerance is how long you tolerate the painful situation before giving up. If only life were like research. In pain studies, the subjects can terminate the painful stimulus whenever they want. Where we runners have the advantage is pain tolerance. So, for example, Israeli researchers applied heat to subjects' arms to measure pain threshold, when the heat becomes painful, and pain tolerance, how long the subjects could tolerate the heat once they found it painful. The subjects were 19 triathletes and 17 non-athletes. The key takeaways were that the triathletes had much greater pain tolerance. They described the pain as less intense, and they didn't fear the pain as much as the sedentary subjects. Similarly, a German study had ultramarathon runners and sedentary people stick their hand in a bucket of ice water for 3 minutes. All 11 of the ultra runners kept their hand in the bucket for the stipulated time, even though they thought it was painful. On average, they rated that pain as a 6 out of 10. A control group of 11 otherwise similar people who weren't ultra-runners fared much worse. Only 3 of them kept their hand in the bucket for 3 minutes. Their average time was 90 seconds, or just more than half the duration they were encouraged to stick it out for. When the going got tough, the sedentary got going, in the direction of avoiding pain. These findings, however, raise a chicken-or-egg question. Do some of the people do well as athletes because they naturally have a greater pain tolerance, or does being an athlete lead to developing greater pain tolerance? An Australian study circumvented that issue by measuring pain threshold and pain tolerance in a group of non-athletes, and then turning half of them into athletes and remeasuring pain threshold and pain tolerance after 6 weeks of training. The result? On one test, the people who trained increased their pain tolerance by 20%, while their pain threshold didn't change. They found a given sensation as painful as before, but could handle that level of discomfort for significantly longer. The non-athletes were as relatively wimpy or tough as during the first round of testing. It didn't take much training to apparently produce such a dramatic increase in pain tolerance. The people who became exercisers rode a stationary bike 3 times a week for 30 minutes at a time at a moderate intensity. It's worth noting that the mode of exercise was aerobic. The Israeli researchers who examined triathletes have tested the pain sensitivity of athletes in non-aerobic sports, such as powerlifting, and found they score roughly the same as sedentary people. It's also worth noting that some of the pain tolerance tests were done on the participants' arms. The pain tolerance test in question consisted of withstanding a tourniquet that decreased blood flow and increased pain. Cycling, of course, doesn't specifically target arm muscles, so the increase in pain tolerance couldn't be attributed to the exercisers becoming used to discomfort there. This result provides evidence for a central mechanism as the primary modulator of the increased pain tolerance, and suggests a new psychological adaptation to training, the researchers note. Although the new exercisers rode at a moderate intensity, they were beginners. For them, 3 half-hour workouts a week presumably counted as hard work. For regular runners, gains in toughness might be analogous to gains in racing fitness. Basic getting in the miles training will get you far, but adding intensity will get you farther. A British study found that people who did high-intensity cycling workouts for 6 weeks improved their pain tolerance at the end of that time more than did people who did only moderate-intensity cycling. Every time you do the hard thing, the brain benefits, says clinical psychologist Laura Fredendahl. Getting fit can make you tougher, and getting tougher might also help you get that much more fit, the researchers speculate. In their words, exercise training may facilitate the development of brain function that increases tolerance of these signals and associated sensations, and this increase in tolerance may contribute to improved endurance performance. When I described these athletes are tougher studies to Brooks, he said they made sense from his professional perspective. The cognitive part of that is that you're able to challenge that automatic first thought of, I can't do this. You have daily experience of challenging those thoughts and not automatically granting them validity. Tapping your toughness. Research that complements endurance athletes on our toughness comes with a caveat. We might be just as wimpy as everyone else when we're under acute psychological stress. In a subsequent study, the original Triathletes Are Toughies researchers again measured pain threshold and pain tolerance in a group of triathletes. And not just any old triathletes, but highly ambitious ones who trained an average of 16 hours a week and raced an average of 12 times a year. The triathletes told the researchers they regularly experienced moderate to high levels of physical and mental stress in training and competition. If anyone had gained real-life resilience from their athletic pursuits, these triathletes were good candidates. This time, the triathletes underwent the pain tests before and during a common psychological test designed to induce stress. The researchers gathered not only the triathletes' subjective reports of stress, but also measured levels of cortisol, a stress hormone in the triathletes' saliva. The psychological test, called the Montreal Imaging Stress Task, is dastardly by design. For 8 minutes, the triathletes were presented with arithmetic tasks on a computer screen. As they completed each one, the screen told them whether they'd answered correctly and provided an ongoing tally of how they were doing compared to the average performance on the task. Before the test, the triathletes were told that the average person got 80 to 90% of the tasks right. That sounds stressful enough, But here's the cruel twist. The test was programmed so that, regardless of one's answers, the screen would always show a correct response rate of 25 to 45%. To make things worse, after the first test, the subjects were told they'd done poorly and that they'd have to do the test over. After the second test, the subjects were again told they'd performed well below average. The main finding? During acute psychological stress, in this case, seeing and being told they were failing at a pressure-packed task, the triathlete's pain thresholds decreased significantly. In fact, their sensitivity to pain became essentially the same as that of the sedentary subjects in the earlier study. One of the researchers, Ruth Dufrin, PhD of Tel Aviv University, says that any event that's marked by unpredictability and that's not under your control could be stressful enough to have the effect found in her research. There was at least one important way in which the triathletes remained different, namely, their willingness to see the stressful situation through to the end. Despite the stress-induced increased sensitivity to pain caused by the tests, the researchers wrote, triathletes do persevere in extreme efforts, even if these involve considerable pain and stress. Running, perhaps in part because it naturally makes us adept at practicing cognitive behavioral therapy, can give us applicable resilience in other areas of life. We know how to endure, even when hampered or hamstrung by depression or anxiety. When it comes to depression or anxiety-related problems, there's the idea that exercise builds hardiness, says J. Carson Smith, Ph.D., a brain researcher at the University of Maryland. Studies like the one on triathletes' pain tolerance show that we athletes are better at dealing with stress in the moment. According to Smith, regularly experiencing unpleasant situations might improve your baseline ability to handle them, similar to how regular long runs make any one long run less of a stress. Adapting to a physical activity as a stressor may help you throughout life adapt to these stressors, not only in a physiological manner, but also psychologically, he says. I asked Dufrin how runners can maintain their hard-won toughness in situations like the stressful ones she created in her research. Techniques aimed to reduce stress, such as mindfulness, cognitive behavioral therapy, and social support, might have the potential to improve pain modulation, she says. We've seen that can be the case with CBT. In the next two chapters, we'll look at how to make mindfulness and strong social connections an integral part of your running so that your weekly mileage can better help you manage depression or anxiety. Chapter 8. Running and Mindfulness. Tempo runs weren't always Julia Lucas's favorite thing. When the former pro runner was a member of the Mammoth Track Club in California, she, like everyone else on the team, did them weekly. Lucas was a 5,000-meter specialist. 800-meter repeats on the track were more up her alley than 40 minutes hard on the roads. On one particularly challenging tempo run, Lucas did what many of us would do. She repeatedly checked her watch. You can imagine the main line of thought. Really? Still 28 minutes to go? Her coach, Terence Mahan, was also not enjoying Lucas's tempo run, but for a different reason. After Lucas did one too many time checks, Mahan pulled alongside in a vehicle and yelled, "Stop looking at your damn watch and just run!" Mahan's tone and wording are unlikely to be heard in your local meditation center. His overall message, however, might be. Mahan wanted Lucas to center herself in the present, to become engaged with the moment she found herself in. He wanted her to let go of regrets over the past. Do I feel so bad because of what I ate last night? Worries about the future? How can I possibly do another 20 minutes, especially with that big hill coming up? And judgments about the present. This sucks. He wanted her to just run. He wanted her to be mindful. Running and mindfulness are linked in several ways. As Mahan was urging Lucas to do, Having a present-only, judgment-free mindset can lead to better performance. It can also lead to greater self-awareness, stress relief, and simple enjoyment of running. For fit and sedentary people alike, mindfulness has been shown to help with depression and anxiety. We runners with those conditions can draw on our running-related mindfulness experiences to improve our mental health at other times. We can also cultivate our mindful running prowess to get that much more mental health benefit from our runs. What is mindfulness? You know something is popular when there's a backlash against it. Mindfulness has attained that dubious distinction, as evidenced by such jeremiads as the book Mindlessness, The Corruption of Mindfulness in a Culture of Narcissism, and a Washington Post article, Mindfulness Would Be Good for You If It Weren't So Selfish. The gist of the backlash is that mindfulness, as popularly presented, misrepresents true mindfulness. As the Post article puts it, this ersatz version provides a vehicle for solipsism and an excuse for self-indulgence. It trumpets its own glories, promising health and spiritual purity with trendiness thrown in for the bargain. Mindfulness, these critics say, has become another it's-all-about-me phenomenon in an age of selfies, but that much worse because it comes with a veneer of virtue. In the context of depression, anxiety, and running, mindfulness is best understood along the lines developed by Jon Kabat-Zinn, Ph.D., in the 1970s. A practitioner of Buddhist meditation, Kabat-Zinn peeled away the Eastern ontology to emphasize the practice's effectiveness in reducing stress and anxiety. In his 1994 book, Wherever You Go, There You Are, Mindfulness Meditation in Everyday Life, Kabat-Zinn defines mindfulness as the awareness that emerges through paying attention on purpose in the present moment and non-judgmentally to the unfolding of experience moment by moment. Kabat-Zinn eventually codified his approach into an 8-week course known as Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction. It and similar programs have two main components. First, purposefully observing your thoughts, feelings, and bodily sensations as they happen. Second, orienting yourself to present experience with acceptance rather than judgment. As in cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, the subject of the previous chapter, practitioners learn not to let their thoughts define them. In CBT, one goal is to challenge the validity of thoughts that can lead to undesirable behavior. Mindfulness encourages you to observe a thought without judgment. You accept it rather than challenge it. This different approach has worked its way into clinical practice. Frank Brooks, Ph.D., a clinical social worker, says that he increasingly uses acceptance and commitment therapy, ACT, which incorporates mindfulness in his work. ACT is all about teaching folks to use mindfulness and meditation techniques to accept right where they are at the present time, he says. The commitment is to altering one's thought patterns so that they improve mood. CBT is almost all cognitive. Cognitions lead to feelings, which lead to behaviors. ACT is more about being much more in touch with your mood and what's going on with you physically, which influences your thoughts. There's solid evidence that mindfulness training, a la the Kabat-Zinn approach, helps people with depression or anxiety. A Dutch study found that people with a lifetime history of depression who learned to practice a mindfulness-based version of CBT experienced more moment-to-moment pleasant emotions and were better able to find pleasure in daily activities. A review of studies looking at longer-term benefits of mindfulness concluded that the practice is a viable means of treatment for anxiety and depression. Iranian researchers found that a mindfulness-based version of CBT was as effective as traditional CBT in reducing depressive symptoms. A 2-year study at the University of Oxford found that people who were trained in a mindfulness practice had no more relapse of depressive symptoms than people who took antidepressants. As with other forms of treatment, It's probable that adding regular exercise to mindfulness can make the practice that much more effective. A small study at Rutgers University tracked people with and without depression as they did an 8-week program combining mindfulness practice and exercise. Twice a week, the participants did a seated 20-minute mindfulness meditation, during which they were instructed to bring full attention to their breath. If they found themselves thinking about the past or future, they were to acknowledge this change in thought and then return their attention to their breath. They then continued the meditation while walking slowly for 10 minutes, which doubled as a warm-up for 30 minutes of running or cycling. At the end of the study, both groups of participants reported fewer depressive symptoms. On average, the subjects with depression reported a 40% reduction in symptoms. The group with depression also said they had fewer ruminative thoughts as they learned to use mindfulness to break the cycle of rutted thinking. Neural imaging found improved brain function in areas of the brain associated with cognitive control and conflict monitoring. Taken together, these studies support runners with depression or anxiety experimenting with one of the many mindfulness programs now available. If you do, you'll probably find the practice isn't as exotic as it might seem. As a runner, you naturally experience a form of it all the time. Running is far from mindless. What do you think about when you run? That question, and aren't you worried about your knees, must be the top results when you Google how non-runner should start conversation with runner. My usual answer of whatever is meant to be concise, not curt. But it's perhaps confusing to non-runners who haven't had the pleasure of being fit enough to cruise on autopilot for an hour, watching yourself experiencing the world. People have long been fascinated with what goes on in our mind when we run. Some of what's behind "What do you think about when you run?" is the belief that running is inherently a battle of mind over matter, where you have to will yourself to keep moving through either constant self-motivation or elaborate schemes to distract yourself. That belief underlies inquiries, such as a 1983 research paper titled "Auto-Hypnosis in Long-Distance Runners." The author, Kenneth Callan, M.D., surveyed more than 400 runners on what they think about when they run. Callan reported, over half of the respondents experience a trance-like state with wide variation in depth, along with increased receptivity to internal events, absorption, and vivid visual imagery, all hallmarks of auto-hypnosis. Callan's findings aren't as significant as his conclusion might make you believe. For one thing, he supplied the respondents with descriptions of this trance-like state and asked them whether they've experienced any while running. Examples include, sometimes form mental pictures while running, and become more creative while running. To any longtime runner, these hardly seem like some mystical state, or in Callan's words, unaided hypnotic experiences which occur spontaneously. One of Callan's criteria was have finished a run and been unable to recall everything which occurred during the run. By that standard, I enter auto-hypnosis when I grocery shop or shave. I don't mean to beat up on a well-meaning inquirer from the first running boom. Much of this book is about how we think differently when we run. But one of the great appeals of running is that we don't consciously enact these cognitive processes. They just sort of happen. Within a mile of moderate running, our breathing naturally becomes rhythmic. The pleasantly repetitive cadence of our foot strikes can be felt in our head. Recall what brain researcher J. Carson Smith said in Chapter 4 about a nerve connection between the feet and brain. As we settle in, we tend to exhale on a predictable pre-foot strike schedule. Increased neural activity helps induce a free-flowing thought process. Running usually gets us part of the way toward mindfulness with little effort on our part. Back to my whatever answer to the what do you think about when you run question. It's the most accurate description of what happens on easy runs, when the thoughts just come in and out from who knows where, whether the weather will hold, A song you hadn't thought about for a decade? Your right knee? Your first pet? Tomorrow's meeting? Last year's vacation? Whether you forgot your friend's birthday? Your left hamstring? Your right shoulder? The car that just passed too closely? Whether you locked the house? And on and on and on. And that's all in the first half mile. Letting my mind wander is perhaps a more polite version of my whatever response. Again, what's significant is that these observations of our body, mind, and environment in this present-oriented way occur with no real effort on our part. All that's needed to make the leap to mindfulness is to be non-judgmental about them. My experience is that doing so is much easier while in motion than when sitting. That on-the-run practice then makes success at other times more likely. A twist on this process is to choose an area of focus to reorient yourself if being non-judgmental about your thought stream becomes overwhelming. This might take the form of repeating a phrase or mantra that will recenter you. As we'll see, focusing on a few key areas of running form or your breathing can also work. Phil Wharton, a renowned physiotherapist, told me he'll use a concept such as the color green as his mental lodestar. All these techniques can serve the same purpose as the cliched monk's chant. Perhaps I'm universalizing from my experience, but runners who are past their personal record days might find mindful running easier. We have more practice in accepting our present running reality without judgment, or at least we should, unless we want to not fully enjoy the mental health benefits of running for the next however many decades. What is now my tempo run pace used to be my basic training pace. Accepting that development helps to cultivate the mindset needed for mindfulness. Regardless of where you're at in your running career, the temptation to constantly check splits is an affront to mindfulness. A training partner from my PR days once called out miles splits as we cooled down after a 10K race. Not surprisingly, he was an early adopter of GPS running watches. Perhaps the only benefit of my form of hearing loss is that I can't hear when my current running partner's watches beep to signal another mile has passed. Their wrist flick and quick glance down is a tip-off, though, that they're probably not participating in the unfolding present moment without judgment. Of course, it helps to have a general sense of your fitness, but every mile on every run? What are you going to do with that information? As Terence Mahan might say, stop looking at your damn watch and just run. This is not to imply that mindful running is simply thinking, I'm slow and that's okay. There's some evidence that mindfulness training, as described earlier, is indirectly or directly associated with improved performance. For example, two small studies of athletes found that a short period, 4 to 8 weeks, of mindfulness training resulted in the athletes subsequently scoring higher on measures of, well, mindfulness. This might sound like research showing that 4 weeks of regular crossword puzzle practice makes people better at doing crosswords. Then again, some aspects of mindfulness, such as focusing your attention on your present task and accepting rather than worrying about bodily sensations, can improve performance. These findings aren't entirely dismissible on no-duh grounds. More tantalizing is a follow-up to one of the two aforementioned studies. In the original, researchers at Catholic University found that 4 weeks of mindfulness training improved mindfulness in the study's 25 runners compared to a control group of runners. But they reported at the time no improvements in actual running performance were found. A year later, however, things were different. The long-distance runners exhibited significant improvement in their mile times from pretest to follow-up, with significant correlations between change in runners' performance and trait variables, the researchers wrote. That is, the more the runners exhibited traits of mindfulness, such as not having what the researchers called task-irrelevant thoughts, the more they improved over the year. Of course, all sorts of factors can go into performance. For all we know, during that year, the more mindful runners started eating better or slept more or quit their job to do nothing but meditate and train. Still, if you heard a bunch of runners added an element to their training and improved more than runners who didn't add that element, you'd probably look into it, right? Mindful racing. There's another way in which mindfulness, or at least an aspect of it, can help you run faster. I think of it as converting form cues to mantras. It's a key takeaway from research on attentional focus, or what people concentrate on while running. For years, runners have been told that there are two main coping strategies for the pain of racing: association and disassociation. The conventional wisdom was that association, or focusing on your body's reaction to the stress it's under, is what front-of-the-pack runners do, whereas disassociation, or thinking about other things to take your mind off your suffering, is what slower runners do. The usual take-home lesson was that if you care about performance, you should constantly monitor the feedback your body provides while racing. Irish researchers have shown that things aren't that simple. In line with Terence Mahan's intervention with Julia Lucas, they found that thinking too much about how you're feeling can lead to running slower. The details of this research are complicated, but worth delving into. The first step was to have 20 experienced runners do a 3-kilometer self-paced time trial on a treadmill. That is, the runners controlled the pace of the treadmill and aimed to run 3 kilometers as fast as possible. Every 400 meters, the runners indicated their rating of perceived exertion to the researchers. The runners' splits and heart rate were also recorded throughout. The runners did 2 more treadmill 3-kilometer time trials. In one, with cues from the researchers, they tried to replicate the perceived exertion they had reported at regular intervals during the self-paced time trial. The runners controlled the treadmill's speed during this trial. The treadmill's pace display was hidden to the runners. They simply could make the treadmill go faster or slower. In the other follow-up trial, the researchers controlled the treadmill's speed, which they matched to what the runners had selected at regular intervals in the self-paced trial. In other words, the runners ran the same splits in this trial as in the self-paced one, but the pace was externally controlled. After all of the time trials, the researchers interviewed the runners about what they thought about during the runs. There were a few key differences in some of the variables measured among the 3 time trial setups. One significant result was that in the trial based on running by perceived exertion, the runners' 3-kilometer times were an average of 10% slower. For someone who usually runs 25 minutes for a 5-kilometer race, finishing 10% slower means running 27 minutes 30 seconds, which for that person would usually be considered a bad race. The large difference occurred even though the slower run felt as hard as the faster ones, self-paced and externally paced. Why might that have happened? The answer probably lies in differences in what the runners thought about during the 3 time trials. During the perceived exertion trial, the runners thought much less about specific aspects of running, pacing, improving their form, maintaining a good cadence, than during the other 2 trials. Instead, during the perceived exertion trial, they thought a lot more about the more general notion of effort/feel than they did in the self-paced and externally paced trial. But wait, shouldn't we monitor ourselves while racing to make sure we're running at an effort level we can maintain to the finish? Isn't this what the association-disassociation model says elites do? If we focus too much on how we are feeling, then we are doing that at the expense of other attentional strategies that are beneficial to performance. Lead researcher Noel Brick, PhD, told me via email. Mental strategies like focusing on cadence, relaxing, technique, etc., can improve our pace without elevating our sense of effort. So check in periodically, do a body scan, see how everything is feeling. If everything feels good, focus back on those strategies that will help you run at your best. Brick's advice is consistent with what many top runners say they think about while racing. After his unlikely victory at the 2014 Boston Marathon, Meb Keflezighi told me that in the last mile, when he was exhausted and his lead had shrunk to 6 seconds, he told himself, "Technique, technique, technique." When racing, Keflezighi internally repeats well-practiced form cues, such as quick feet or relaxed shoulders. Doing so keeps him in the present and focuses his thoughts on something more specific than his overall fatigue, which might cause him to regret earlier race decisions or worry about the remaining miles. Brick calls this task-appropriate focus of attention. This form cue as mantra technique has another big benefit. It should directly result in greater running efficiency, allowing you to run faster without increasing your perceived exertion. That approach is in line with the other key finding from Brick's study. On average, the runner's heart rate was 2% lower during the time trial when the researchers controlled the treadmill speed. As a reminder, the researchers matched the treadmill's speed to the settings the runners had chosen in the self-paced time trial. So, the runners covered 3 kilometers in the same time in both settings and with the same splits. But when the pace was set for the runners, even though it was the same pace they'd set for themselves, they completed the time trial at a slightly lower heart rate. This finding suggests that the runners could have completed the time trial faster if, for example, the researchers had let the runners set the pace for the final 400 meters. Theoretically, the lower heart rate at the same pace should have given them the reserves to finish with a good kick. The 2% reduction in heart rate during the externally controlled pace trial was unexpected, Brick says. But when we analyzed what the runners focused on, keeping relaxed and optimizing running action, then it made sense. We feel that the choice of mental strategy helped to improve movement economy, and this was reflected in the 2% reduction in heart rate. Brick says this finding can have important practical applications. When the researchers controlled the pace, the runners didn't have to worry whether they were going too fast or too slow. Using form cues, they could focus on running as efficiently as possible at the given pace. The externally controlled condition may be likened to running with a pacemaker, Brick says. If you are in a race with pacemakers, use them. Let them do all the pace-related decision-making. Instead, check periodically how you were feeling and focus on keeping relaxed and running efficiently. If there are no pacemakers, try to run with similar ability runners. Maybe let this pack do your pace setting while you focus on keeping relaxed and efficient. I don't want to come across as Mr. Anti-GPS, but it's important to note here that following an external pacemaker is different from doing what you set your watch to do. Brick and other researchers believe constantly monitoring these devices is a poor attentional strategy. Christopher Fullerton, PhD, of the University of Kent in England, has investigated the intersection of psychology and pace. In A Runner's Guide to Sports Psychology and Nutrition, he writes, "Running with a GPS watch alone creates unnecessary anxiety around trying to religiously stick to a predetermined pace that could be unrealistic, for example, if the weather changes. Tucking in at the beginning of the race or running with a group of runners could in fact be an effective strategy for decreasing the perception of effort required to sustain the pace you are trying to run." Brick agrees, saying, "Our data backs this up. It might be better for runners to focus on strategies that will optimize performance and periodically check how they are feeling. I would suggest that constantly checking pace on a GPS device will distract from this process." After all, some of the strategies used by runners in Brick's study and elites like Keflezighi, such as relaxing tense body parts and focusing on good form, should lead to running more efficiently. The same can't be said for staring at your wrist and stressing that the last tenth of a mile was too slow. Mindful running can also lead to a performance boost that can have nothing to do with faster times, but everything to do with the runs we all dream about. Going with the flow. One of the main points of this book is that any run is better than no run for mental health benefits. That's not to say all runs are equal. We've all had those precious day of days runs where everything clicks, where the barrier between you and the runner and the run you're doing becomes porous, where you feel content and capable and would rather not be doing anything else. Kenneth Callan might call this auto-hypnosis. Mihai Csikszentmihalyi has more famously and more accurately called this state flow. Csikszentmihalyi, a Hungarian psychologist, introduced the concept of flow in the 1970s. Driven by the belief that people are happiest when they experience flow, Csikszentmihalyi has worked to popularize the concept. Flow is often equated to being in the zone, which helps with quick comprehension, but doesn't delineate what he means. Here's Csikszentmihalyi himself, writing in his 2017 book, Running Flow. In general, flow occurs when you believe you have the skills necessary to overcome a challenging situation. Your perception of time warps as your attention narrows to the task at hand. This attention is so sharply focused on the task that all extraneous thoughts and anxieties disappear. Clear goals drive your actions, while all internal and external feedback verifies that the goal is achievable. Despite feeling invincible, you are aloof to what others think of you as your self-consciousness recedes into the background. All that matters is mastering the moment. Flow and mindfulness have much in common, including purposeful focus on the present, paying attention to mind, body, and environment, and a respite from regrets about the past and worries about the future. These are powerful payoffs for runners with depression or anxiety. With the sense of mastery it brings and its goal orientation, flow also produces strong feelings of self-efficacy. A small 2011 study on athletes found another link. Some of the subjects received mindfulness training twice a week for 6 weeks. The others didn't. At the end of the study, the mindfulness group reported significantly more frequent flow experiences than at the beginning, whereas the control group's frequency didn't change. You may have been lucky enough to experience flow during a race. More often, it happens on daily runs, be they track workouts, easy trail runs, or medium-pace road runs. Csikszentmihalyi says that running in natural settings can make flow experiences more likely. That idea meshes well with what we saw in Chapter 4 about greater mood improvements and more favorable brain chemistry than when we do the same activity in nature versus human-made environments. When I give running the attention it deserves, I experience flow a few times a month. It happens most often running on trails under a canopy of trees. I'm engaged, but not overwhelmed by picking good footing. Peripherally, I have a general impression of natural beauty. I navigate twists and turns, ups and downs, as if I'm an extension of the trail. I wish I could stay in the forest forever. As morning light speckles my surroundings, I'm overcome with a sensation best articulated as simply, yes. Yes to the moment, yes to whatever is in store the rest of the day, yes to life itself. If I could bottle that feeling, I'd eventually forget what it's like to be depressed. Chapter 9. Running and Strong Social Connections. I wish The Loneliness of the Long-Distance Runner had never been written. Not because it's a bad short story. I wouldn't know. I haven't read it. It's the title that's bothersome. It's entered the general culture as a supposedly apt description of the runner's lot. Some of us cotton to it on our more martyrly runs. Part of the problem stems from the word connotation. The popular image of the solo runner assumes they're suffering from lack of company. But that's confusing being lonely with being alone. You've probably had many runs where you'd agree with Henry David Thoreau's contention that I never found the companion that was so companionable as solitude. I sometimes feel most lonely in a crowd, thanks to bombast-induced alienation, and a yearning for in-depth conversation the situation is unlikely to allow. The bigger issue is that being a runner more often means camaraderie than loneliness. Group track workouts, long runs with friends, post-race cool-downs with competitors, these and other bond-producing elements are part of the fabric of running. Even when you're running by yourself, you're aware that you're part of a worldwide web of fellow runners. You aren't lonely, spend most of your waking hours flitting among social media feeds, and working a job where more than small talk is rare, and not having an avocation like running that nurtures meaningful connections. For runners with depression or anxiety, the social aspect of the sport might not seem to be primary to its appeal. Many of us are introverted and have no trouble logging most of our miles alone. Feeling connected to others, however, is often more a matter of quality than quantity. We're fortunate as runners to have a built-in way to forge the connections that can improve our mental health. I'm so lonesome I could cry. The relationship of loneliness to mental health issues, especially depression, is well established. The American Psychological Association lists social isolation as a risk factor for depression. Loneliness and depression can feed off each other, as a lack of energy or interest in activities keeps you homebound. Excusing yourself from social activities seems easier than mounting the strength to smile and chat while you're miserable inside. These feelings tend to compound with age. Old friends become dispersed, and their schedules harder to mesh with. Opportunities for making new friends narrow, as a good chunk of most weeks is devoted to getting to, from, or being at work. Many new relationships seem to lack the depth of those from our earlier years. It often feels that we gain acquaintances, not friends. Dutch research on people over the age of 60 found that over a 2-year period, those who said they were lonely reported greater depressive symptoms at the end of the study. Animal studies have found a direct link between social isolation and less favorable brain chemistry. Researchers at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology measured levels of dopamine, a neurotransmitter linked to pleasure and reward, in the dorsal raphe nucleus area of the brain in mice. The dorsal raphe nucleus is involved in such physiological functions as learning, memory, and affect, or your emotional reaction to a stimulus, such as anger or euphoria. Its greatest neurotransmitter is serotonin, which is partly why it's thought to be related to depression. In the study, the mice were isolated from one another and then brought back together. Even after just 24 hours of isolation, when the mice were reunited, activity significantly increased in the dopamine-related neurons of the dorsal raphe nucleus. By simulating loneliness, the researchers appeared to show how brain health improves with social connections. Of course, many of us feel more connected than ever, thanks to social media and other digital ways of staying in touch. But there's increasing evidence that these ties are no substitute for personal interaction. A now famous study found that over 2 weeks, the more people used Facebook, the worse they subsequently felt, and the more their satisfaction with their lives declined over time. These findings did not happen in regard to the subject's direct social interactions. University of Pittsburgh researchers have found that, among young adults, the ones who spent the most time on social media had significantly higher odds of being depressed. The same researchers found that those who spent 2 or more hours per day on social media were twice as likely to feel socially isolated than those who spent less than half an hour a day on social media. Humans evolved as social beings. Physical intimacy and satisfying interpersonal interactions result in elevated levels of oxytocin, a neurotransmitter that produces the warm glow associated with bonding. Even we introverts need regular in-person exposure to others. We just tend to feel those helpful connections in smaller circles of close associates compared to extroverts. With running, just connect. Enter Running. As I said, it comes with a built-in way to create and strengthen just the sort of relationships that improve mental health. If, like me, you took up the sport as part of a school team, regularly running with others has been part of your running life since day one. If you're an adult onset